Hello and welcome to the Weird Things Podcast. I'm Andrew Main, joined by Justin Robert Young.
Hola.
And Mr. Brian Brushwood.
Howdy, howdy, hello.
Gentlemen, good news, good news. That asteroid that was predicted to have a 3% chance of hitting the Earth reduced to a 1.5% chance. What are you going to do with that data?
I'm going to breathe a big sigh of relief, and I'm going to root and cheer. I'm going to believe in God, and I'm going to say, hooray, that pass, it's going to land. I'm going to wear my favorite jersey. That's what I'm going to do.
So wait a minute. It was at 1%, then it got upgraded to 3%. Now it's back at 1%?
1.5%.
Gotcha. What is changing? What new data are we getting?
Well, it's more precise. And I was like, yes, I understand in the rational world why 1.5% chance of being hit is better than a 3% chance of getting hit. But my monkey brain goes, chance of being hit and
still not zero.
Not zero. And by the way, 0.8% chance of it hitting the moon. So we're roughly at a 2.3% chance of seeing something.
Okay. So all things being equal, we're all fine with complete miss, right? That's the 96%, 97%, right? We're very not okay with the hitting Earth. But all things being equal, would you rather have it be a total miss, or would it be kind of like winning the lottery to watch it hit the moon?
That's where it gets tricky. We remember we had when we watched a comet go into
Shoemaker-Levy. When Shoemaker-Levy hit Jupiter, that was an astronomical bonanza. It really was like winning the lottery of data for interplanetary dynamics.
Yeah, and Jupiter's so big, it's like, don't hurt me, bro.
Yeah, right? It's like, whatever. It's just a scratch. Not even.
So we're all stupid. Well, I am stupid when it comes to like space stuff and like asteroid impacts. So part of me is like, yeah, sounds cool. Watch it hit the moon, you know, get the popcorn. But then I don't know, like, is there some disaster scenario where all this lunar regolith gets kicked up into there and reaches, because remember, escape velocity from the moon is much lower than Earth. So you're going to have stuff that's very likely going to reach escape velocity, and you're going to get a cloud of lunar dust.
I mean,
then
this
what
is,
happens?
Well, let's for a brief moment, in possibly a way that'll be a bad look years from now, but don't worry, the internet will be wiped out anyway. The prettiest version of this is a version where the moon gets dinged and an extraordinary amount of dust basically creates the world's greatest light show. Or all that dust comes down and literally ignites the atmosphere on fire, and we all burn up because we essentially have a silo fire, a dust fire.
I'm going to ask Deep Research to tell me what this about if this hit the moon.
Have you guys, maybe this will be my pick. There's Neal Stephenson's book, Seven Eves, speculates for, it glosses over it very quickly. It says something quantum black hole popped in and out of existence just long enough to sear through like a lightning bolt through the moon. And so essentially the moon just explodes and it becomes like seven cool moonlets up there. And you've got one of the main characters is a Neil deGrasse Tyson / Carl Sagan type, and he's on a version of The Tonight Show, and he's doing clever nicknames for the seven different chunks of the moon and talking about how they're going to look and evolve over time. And then meanwhile, quietly, everyone's running the numbers and they realize, yeah, these orbital, all the orbits are screwed up. Eventually, all seven of these are going to crash down and all of Earth is truly going to be destroyed. And then that's the depressing remainder of the entire story. But that information wave, that dawning horror and realization, as made for in late night talk show sound bites, I could totally see something happening. Anyway, I hope it's not a documentary, Seven Eves.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a case where, again, I'm, you know, sometimes I watch stuff and I go, no, that's not how it would play out at all. And then I find out sometimes things play out even more stupidly than I would. Like, I was watching some TV show about, I don't want to get into the name pick on the show, but it was like, oh, what if there was like a, it was a Tom Clancy premise that they took, which is like, what if all the, you know, houses, the basically the line of succession led to like an unpopular Trump, or, you know, excuse me, cabinet pick, like, you know, a cabinet pick got picked as the president. Right. And, and they show this attack on the Capitol building that blows up everybody. And it's treated like kind of like a downtown fire. You know, some people are at a DC bar. Well, I'm going to go show up on the scene, see what's going on. And like literally like the next day they show, you know, one of the people works in the White House is being racially profiled, which is wrong, but it's the camera does sort of a sad long take. So are we really doing this? I'm like, I think if we have 9/11 2.0, yes, 100% that would happen. And it was just this weird, like, this doesn't feel like a real reaction, but then we're 5 years in and you can, people still want to go like, did COVID leak from a lab? Do we really know? And it's like, okay, well, why didn't we spend like a colossal effort to find a reservoir species and all this thing, the most devastating pandemic in recent, you know, last 100 years, we really haven't been asking a lot of critical questions. So your point, Brian, about this, like, I'd be like, well, if you have like a breaks up in a 70, I would assume that we'd start be calculating, like, you know, is it going to hit the earth? But then I'm like, there are people like, it doesn't matter where it came from. Do we really care? So I don't know. Long way to go into. It was likely a lab leak, everybody. Just
good. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler alert. We don't care. We just don't. We're not.
I think the moon should be wherever it wants. We should stop restricting the moon. It should be able to break up into seven pieces.
I brought that up because there was the Wuhan Institute of Virology just announced that they've been working on a new virus, doing it in a BLS safety level of 2. And it's like, oh, geez,
I think great. I would have canceled my PR Newswire account if I were the Wuhan Institute of Virology after COVID. I would probably say, you want to know,
or like, maybe do a rebranding, change your name.
New coronavirus discovered in Chinese bat sparks alarm. Chinese team finds new bat coronavirus can affect humans via same runs of COVID-19. Don't have, it is the same people that probably created the original virus. Whoops. Are now like, hey, you like the 1.0? And of course, they're all like, no, it didn't come from here. Why would you say that? So, yeah.
Will DeepSeek tell you about that? Is that on the list of things that DeepSeek can't talk about? Is whether or not COVID emanated from the Wuhan Institute of Virology?
All the models would be very. They're like, well, the zoonotic is widely supported. Like, okay, show me where the support is now for it, and the retraction, the criticism of the papers. None of the formal papers have been retracted. All this should be because of all disclosures of like, 19 out of 20 people worked on that grant didn't tell you.
Yeah,
you know, it's like, So anyhow, sorry for derailing. It's been a while, but yeah, why does it matter where it came from? The answer is very simply, it's how you prevent the next one. If there's a lab in China that's producing these things, if a nuclear cloud came over Europe and we're looking at Russia and Russia's like, not us. And we're like, man, our Geiger counters are going off. Would we be like, it's okay, bro. Whatever. Carry on.
I want to go back to knowing whether or not I should, I need to go buy some pennants and jerseys, and I need to know what they say. I need to know what I'm rooting for this asteroid to do. Also, does the asteroid have a name? And why is it Wuhan Labs asteroid?
2024 YR4. So I've got our deep research is still working, Brian. So I was stalling for it.
Okay.
We've got the best minds on it right now.
We do.
I am certainly we all have this. And so I'm going to say it and then I'm going to be criticized for it, but everybody admit it. We all have this morbid part of us that whenever you say, I'm going to do a big thing or have a big impact or do a thing, we crave change. And if we think that change doesn't negatively affect us, we kind of want to see it like a fireworks show. Like literally, I was just at Disneyland. And at the end of the night, we go explode things in the sky. We literally fire rockets at the heavens and we try to blow it up. And we're all like, yeah. So, I mean, we all are on, we all know whether we'll admit it or not. Like, we're like, oh, that'd be really cool.
So, you know, we had not, we'd been talking about this asteroid coming, and I think this is the first time we brought up the possibility of the probability of a moon impact. And it makes me remember, I'll have to look up the name of the book, but we talked about it. I think it was 12, 13 years ago that I read that the core thesis of the book was, hey, pretty unusual that planet Earth has intelligent life. Could be that we're the only ones, because you know what else is unusual? Earth is the only body in the solar system that has a large single gravitational moon. And the idea essentially was none of the other planets are likely to have life because no matter how far up the timeline of, you know, intelligent life they become, there's an extinction level event, something hits the planet, but because Earth used to be bigger, got hit by a planetoid, smashed, and you know, we had you know, the Earth and the moon in their tidal lock. Essentially, the moon acts like a blocker, as a bodyguard, essentially, that reduces, not all of them, I'm looking at you dinosaurs, but enough extinction level event asteroids that we finally had enough timeline to reach intelligence. And that could also account for why we haven't found, you know, it was just a cosmic coincidence that Earth happens to have a bodyguard and the moon is that bodyguard, which I found to be a pretty compelling case.
So I'll give you a couple I thought about this too, and a couple thoughts on that. Number one is, you know, obviously we suffer from the lack of data, you know, that our ability to sort of know, and when given that there are trillions of planets in our galaxy alone, that kind of makes it hard to sort of estimate, you know, what is the likelihood of that, of, you know, what one is that the assumption is that how would we know if there's intelligent life out there? Because when we look at like radio signals, things like this, and how they propagate, et cetera, it's hard to know. Certainly you can create a just so story where because we have the moon and whatnot, that made it work out. But, you know, the other argument though is like, you know, the asteroid that hit us 65 million years ago, was a great that all of a sudden allowed new species to flourish, right? And there's the idea that, you know, what if, you know, every 10 million years you get an asteroid that's like that, you know, every million years, do you all of a sudden accelerate the process? Because all of a sudden you start whittling away these older, very well adapted systems that don't evolve very quickly to newer systems that have faster reproductive cycles, et cetera. You know, so I could say that like you can almost make the argument that like as long as you're not completely wiping away the atmosphere, maybe you could get it, because it's we're working backwards from this. Why isn't there more life? But we're going, well, why is there more life in the early detectable part of our galaxy versus?
So maybe you can have a little impact as a treat.
Yeah,
and I believe I heard the size of this asteroid being a city killer. Is that what they said? Like it would wipe out a city, and then there'll be, you know, yet to be determined environmental impacts for a long time to come.
So what's great is using ChatGPT's deep research, I got a full report on this with sources and citations and everything. I'm just going to share my screen with you, Brian, here, if you want to see this. It is quite remarkable, you know, the ability to ask these systems these questions and to get like basically what would look like something I'd find in a science journal.
Mm-hmm.
So we get the potential effects of a 90 meter asteroid impact on the moon. And I'll just read the first paragraph.
Yeah. See if you can make that jumbo sized, if that's easy for you to do.
Yeah. Let me try to shrink this down and see if that helps.
Hey, there we go.
Yeah. So pro trip, everybody, if you want to increase the size of a window, counterintuitively shrink it on the video. Asteroid 2024 is a near Earth object about 40 to 90 meters, 130 to 300 feet wide. If such a city killer asteroid struck the moon, it would release a tremendous amount of energy on the order of 10 to 16 to 10 to the 17 joules, equivalent to several to tens of megatons of TNT. For context, this is hundreds of times more energy than the Hiroshima atomic bombs and comparable to a larger hydrogen bomb. The Tunguska event of 1908, which flattened 2,000 square kilometers of Siberian forest, was caused by an object 30 to 50 meters in size, releasing 5 to 15 megatons in an air burst. Unlike Tunguska, an asteroid explosion, an impact on the airless moon means the full energy would go into the lunar surface, Below, we analyze the expected outcomes, the crater size, ejecta distribution, orbital effects, and visibility impact comparison to past impacts, indirect effects on Earth, and the appearance of such events. So anyhow, I'm just going to scan through that, but like, it's amazing that we got this, report. Like, it's just incredible.
Well, and the important things, if anybody hasn't played around with, this is called which mode again?
This is deep research.
Deep research brings receipts. And that's something that I keep having to, that's so new that I have to tell that to a lot of people, because people have tinkered around enough that they're all like, oh, ChatGPT, that's the thing that doesn't always get things right. And it's like, well, it depends on the model, but deep research comes back with papers that are linked external from the report for you to look at with your own eyes.
It does research. You can see its chain of logic as it thinks through the problem and where it's going and why it is double checking certain things. I used it last night because we were, just kind of noodling around on ideas for future seasons of World's Greatest Con. And it was remarkable to just go from, there's one particular person that we were like looking for odd stories about, things that you might not have heard. And not only did it list a bunch of them, but then I like gave it a premise for one of the ideas. It was like, no, actually the facts do not support your premise at all. And then I was like, oh, okay, well, what else? Give me more facts about it. Totally did big research report. And then eventually I was like, oh, can you put together a research report with this idea as a premise? And it's like, yes, the facts do support that. And here it is. And I was able to send Brian and Will, our editor, just a full report that
and not only that, but the whole thread thus far, just like the GPT is reporting on its chain of thought, I'm able to see the meta chain of thought of, oh, Justin really was hoping this cool narrative structure would happen to turn out. It didn't. Then he went this way. Now this is where we're at. And then the even more amazing part is, after getting all the way caught up, I mean, it's low grade telepathy. I got to clairvoyantly experience the past of what Justin had gotten up to that point. And then true telepathy happened, because I get to continue Justin's chain of thought on an independent thread that I can then send back to Justin. It's astonishing.
So give you the impact, they would say that it would probably create maybe a crater 1 to 2 meters in size. They say minimal amounts of debris would probably hit the Earth, so we seem like we might be okay there. When it talks about what we would see, visibility of the impact from Earth.
This is if it hits the moon?
Yeah, if it hits the moon. And then so upon impact, kinetic energy is partly converted to heat and light. The impact would erupt into an extremely hot explosion of molten rock and vapor. This manifests as a bright flash of light and could be visible from Earth. In previous observed lunar impacts, even tiny meteorites produced detectable flashes. The September 2013 lunar impact from a 1 meter rock was the brightest recorded. It created a flash visible to the naked eye by experienced observers, with an afterglow lasting about 8 seconds. That flash was described as easily spotted from Earth if one was watching, despite the small size of the impactor. For a 40 to 90 meter asteroid, the flash would be orders of magnitude higher. It could momentarily rival the brightness of the moon's surface itself. Observers on Earth, night sight, looking at the moon, would see a sudden point of light on the lunar disk. Depending on the impact and timing, it could be visible naked eye under dark skies. More likely, anyone with a small telescope or even binoculars who happened to be watching the moon would notice a brilliant flare. More likely, so it would last a few orders of a few seconds, up to perhaps 10 seconds, tens of seconds as hot impact plume grew. So.
That's amazing.
Yeah. So then it goes into a comparison of past objects, et cetera. During the Apollo era, Saturn V upper stages mass 15 tons were reportedly crashed on the moon. These impacts at 2.5 kilometers per second formed craters 35 millimeters across. They were small compared to the natural high speed asteroid impacts with a divided calibration. So,
damn. So, I didn't know that we just shot a rocket right up into the moon.
Now I'm like, I gotta check this.
Wait, was it the rocket? Or I know that there was a piece of, there was a satellite that they were like, well, this thing needs to deorbit, and all things being equal, we think there may be water on the polar, there may be ice caps on the moon. So it's like, if we got to crash it anyway, let's just throw it in there.
The Saturn IVB was responsible for propelling astronauts towards the moon. And this was like one of the things where they're trying to do the orbits. The IVV stage was typically either deliberately crashed onto the moon's surface or left in solar orbit, depending upon the mission. So
it's big.
So that's pretty. So there's NASA has the SAT Apollo 13 SIVB. Oh, wow. I'm going to share this with you. This is the more you know. This is the impact site. This is on NASA's website. This is where they show the Saturn Apollo 13 impact site for the upper stage.
Oh, look at that.
That's pretty cool.
We're going to get a video here. So our audience, imagine the moon with a crater. Congratulations. You're now.
Is this a simulation? Yeah, this has to be a simulation. Yeah.
Yeah. So we're seeing zoom in and then showing us like what the impact site is. Another zoom. And yeah, wow. So I did not know that. And I thought I knew a lot about, you know, the Apollo program. we've been slamming stuff into the moon for a long time. Asteroid 2024, whatever.
Yeah, man. I'd say bring us your best, but I don't mean it. What I mean is bring us your middling to, you know, just phone it in. How about you phone it in? Maybe call in sick. Who cares?
My favorite is the Science Alert title is NASA has some good news about the asteroid that could hit Earth. And that reminds me of the line from Oppenheimer. Like, well, we only think there's a 0.000 chance the atmosphere cut. Well, what would you like? Zero chance. Yeah. That's what I want. Science doesn't work that way. I've got a couple stories here. One of the big stories this week is not an AI story, guys. Don't worry.
We look at that.
AI, but that was an AI story. Brian, I have a question for you. How are your Majorana particles doing?
My major what?
Answer his question. Stop avoiding it.
My major auto particles?
Yeah, your Majorana fermions. How are they doing? What are your Majorana particles like? Are they good? Is he good right now?
What's he putting around?
I had to take a lot of tests. I had a physical. I forgot to ask about this one. My auto pheromones?
Yeah. So it's basically the opposite of a Dirac fermion.
Yes. Of course, okay. Fermions. Okay. By the way, here's the game I'm playing from context. I assume that these are named for Enrico Fermi, who worked on the Manhattan Project and is famous for his Fermi problems. I'm going to assume that they're small particles that I ain't never heard of before. Otto, I don't know what that part would be.
Yeah. Well, Majorana are named for Ettore Majorana, and so basically it was a proposed particle that you would find when you get into, you know, you go into your standard model and start to look around, like, what makes up everything, and what if we smash some things together? And so it basically, in the theory, this is not me knowing this, by the way, this is me reading from Wikipedia, to make it very clear. Anyhow, the reason this comes up, but like it goes back to, he had a suggestion in 1937 that electrically neutral spin 1/2 particles can be described as a real valued equation. The point is, what we're trying to get at here, all of that is to get to the point. Microsoft says that they have made the first topological qubits, and basically they've created their own quantum computing system that uses an exotic state of matter. And basically they have the Majorana 1 processor, which uses this weird state of matter to basically do quantum processing. So some dude in 1937 proposed some particle and says that would affect the state of matter. And now Microsoft's like, yeah, we built a chip that uses this now.
So, oh man, you know, it used to be in the early days of this program, I would always feel the need to catch people up, but with everything you just said, I don't know how far back to catch people up to, like, that's amazing.
Let me read from Science Alert.
I want to say, well, first of all, you got to know that stuff falls downward. This is called gravity.
They have, Science Alert has it, and they've got that Microsoft made a video of it, but I'll just read from here. Microsoft has taken a very different approach to its topological qubits. They've used what are called Majorana particles, first theorized in 1937 by Italian physicist Ettore Majorana. Neutrinos are not naturally occurring particles like electrons or protons. Instead, they only exist inside of a rare kind of material called a topological superconductor, which requires advanced material design and to be cooled down extremely low temperatures. So we've heard about before, like Bose-Einstein condensate, stuff like this. This is basically when you super cool things, they take on strange properties. And basically when you start to slow down the motion of things, you get weird quantum effects where all of a sudden an object has to sort of pick a state to be in, and it can be kind of weird and hard for it to do that. It's like when you think about like, is it a particle, a wave, a light, a photon, a particle or a wave? It's like, well, when you start to like get into super cold physics and stuff, that's when you start to see the weirdness become more visible. And so Marginal particles are so exotic, they're only studied at universities, not used for practical applications. The Microsoft team say they've used a pair of tiny wires, each with a major amount of particle trapped at either end, to act as a qubit. They measure the value of the qubit expressed by means of whether an electron is on one wire or the other using that. So basically, they've said that, hey, we've been able to take advantage of these facts, these particles do exist, and to be able to put them into a quantum state or capitalize on that.
And I assume right now we're not doing anything remotely efficient, but more proof of concepts. Like, for example, this is already, I mean, 2 decades ago was the first time I heard about this is very useful for, I heard about it in DNA computers and quantum computers even more so. But basically, tell me if I get this right. We'll play this game. Regular computers, single processor, has to do a thing, jump over to a task, jump back, right? Then now we have actual multi-core, actual parallel processors. And of course, graphic GPUs, you know, in parallel are able to do a lot in parallel. Even more parallel would be solving, for example, the traveling salesman problem, where it's like, You got 7 different locations that you got to go to. What is the shortest route to get to all of them most efficiently? To do that in series, you have to, let's try this way. Now let's try this way. Now let's try this way. Whereas in DNA, it's like, let's code a bunch of DNA sequences, throw it all in a soup, shake it all up. And then the two that find each other and fit, it's like, well, now let's run the math. That appears to be the shortest route. Nothing else seems to be able to beat it. And now with quantum computers, what if instead of bazillions and bazillions of chains of DNA, all in a finite amount of soup, what if it was infinite everything's jittering of atoms?
DNA computing was never really going to be that efficient.
Right, sure. But at least I could comprehend the appeal to each of these. But then with quantum, now we're dealing with quantum states where essentially, you know, it's virtually infinite parallel. Is that correct?
Yeah. I mean, I like to think of it like, you know, having a transistor that can, you know, basically, you know, have in you know, an exponent amount of abilities to be able to replicate its capability. You know, the idea that if I can just, you know, if the problem is solvable, that there's a certain number of qubits I can use to solve it. But like just the idea of like, if, you know, kind of using the, like Google came out and said, hey, we think this supports the multi-world. So it's basically say, let me have a circuit that's trying to solve this across, you know, 1,000 different dimensions at the same time and come back with the answer, which isn't necessarily how it really works. But for me, that's my construct, to sort of say that like, oh, if I can have 10,000 versions of this thing running simultaneously in different, you know, parallel worlds, and the one that has the right solution comes back, you know, would be, you know, kind of my way of thinking about it. But the kind of what you get into is that quantum computing is probably kind of like fusion at this point, where the amount of energy and the amount of resources it takes to get it to solve a problem. Still, Google came out with a paper a couple of years ago that said, look, we solved this problem that would take traditional computing like 200 years to do. And then mathematicians and computer scientists said, no, we can do it in an hour. Like you just did a very inefficient way to do this. But we're getting better to now maybe finding examples of, like, are there problems that a quantum computer can solve that literally if I had a $1 billion computing center, I couldn't solve? And we may be much closer to that.
The big one is encryption, right? The idea of if you had infinitely parallel things, and then that's one of the things that I assume is priced into stuff like, say, Bitcoin. Bitcoin would be the vague non-zero possibility of everything being cracked instantly.
Yeah. Yeah, and that was the one of the earlier companies was D-Wave, and so they came out with saying, "Hey, we did a lot of these things," but it was hard to sort of understand if there was how much utility there was to it, because the amount of energy and everything else went to it. And you often find it like, well, no, if I just took 10% of that compute budget or energy budget and put it into a traditional computer, I'd solve it. But we will get to that point. I think we're all kind of convinced that, yeah, we get there. I want to show you an example. This, have you ever seen, this is basically like magnetic bubble memory. This is old school. If you look at this, what we're looking at is basically, it's like, looks like a frame. And then there's a bunch of like wires going across. And at the intersection, these wires are actually like these little, like disks that they go through. And basically you could send a charge through there to set the magnetic charge one way. And then you could read it by sending a current through there. And then you could change it and back and forth. So this is like old school. This is 50 bytes of memory. So this is basically how that used to work of like, I think that was what they called magnetic bubble memory. I saw an example of a bigger chip, and like, this was made by hand, like crocheted basically.
This is basically like a like vacuum tubes level of being able to wrap your mind around it.
Yeah, but it'd be a next level up. Instead of a large vacuum tube, you now your gates are the size of, maybe like a baby aspirin or something smaller. And so you went from that to reduce it. So this was a big technological leap, because now all of a sudden I don't need a big tube or relay to hold the condition of this. And so old computers would be filled with, could be filled with thousands of these things. And it's kind of amazing to look at this. And this is literally something that was made by hand and kind of where we are at quantum computing.
That's remarkable. I mean, it's a little bit almost terrifying to consider like how primitive that looks over just, our lifetime, and then to think how primitive the quantum computer is going to look.
Yeah. Each one of these little nodules you see there is an on-off, is a gate. I mean, that's what's kind of incredibly cool about this. And you could probably program it. We're looking at one that's a bit much bigger. Like, you could probably put a tic-tac-toe game in there.
Yeah.
That's what's crazy about that. But anyhow, hey, Brian, I sent you some links because I want everybody to relax and stop panicking about AI and think about robotics now, because we had two big announcements in the last 48 hours.
let me figure out if in this setup I can get those links open. So here, you tee us up.
So what's funny is there's been a couple. We had Figure Robotics yesterday showed a video of YouTube video of their Helix robots, which if we can see that, it's kind of really amazing. And you see two robots slowly, but solving a problem together in a kitchen, which is cool. And then it is frightening. And then today, the company 1X unveiled their Neo Gamma, which they say they've been putting into homes and having that solve, do tasks. I got a text message from a friend with a very stealthy robotics startup last night, who is like, "Hey, do you know anybody who does video? Because we got to get some video done of our robot." And stuff is just,
it's happening. Popping.
Yeah,
I saw the Neo Gamma video. I don't know if it's only exclusively in very beige homes with families that only wear off-white, but it looks, remarkable. It looks similar to what Tesla demoed in their video, not the ones serving drinks, but
probably not without a person. And the Tesla robots were the ones with people actually tell a robot or operating them.
Yeah. Exactly. But this is just a little robot man who runs around your house and helps with things.
Oh my God, it really does move and walk like Anthony Daniels.
Yeah.
It's funny. I heard an interview with Palmer Luckey on the Sean Ryan show last week, and he spoke about, where the current state of humanoid robotics is. If you're not familiar with Palmer Luckey, he does Anduril, the defense contractor, and of course was the founder and creator of Oculus, which he sold to Facebook. But he was saying that right now, humanoid robotics essentially move, like you said, Brian, at about the speed and gait of like a 70-year-old man.
Yeah.
And like, now that'll eventually get to a 50-year-old man, maybe eventually get to a 40-year-old man, and maybe eventually get to a 30-year-old man. But he was speaking in reference to whether or not, you know, we were going to have these kind of humanoids in the battle arena. But what he was saying is that, like, hey, you know, there are a lot of systems that are really old that require like a staff. So there are some like missile systems and stuff that require like three or four people, and they require a very specific sequencing of things to happen at a certain amount of time. And in a modern warfighting stance, you're probably not going to use those because you don't want to dispatch that many people to be in a situation, in a high-risk situation where an enemy could blow it up. But for this level of robot that is a 70-year-old man, a 70-year-old man can still prime that pump. A 70-year-old man can still turn that key. A 70-year-old man can still do all those things. So it's like, so much of the AI question, the things that are happening now are indeed miracles. They're just, where do we slot them in right now? How, like, what makes sense right now for this level of breakthrough? And the stuff that we're seeing is like, you know, I don't know exactly what the market is going to be for them initially. I suspect it'll probably be, interesting until we see them proven out in the real world. But, you know, they're certainly able to pick up your groceries and probably find interesting ways to put them in your fridge.
Well, and keep in mind, when we talk about legacy systems, like, let's say, for example, I don't know, an F-16 fighter jet. Yeah, that's a very old fighter jet that somebody has laying around. It's not going to be worth it to rip everything out, put in high-tech computer systems in order to, you know, make it a pilotable drone for, I don't know, let's say, you know, a high-risk run or whatever. But that cockpit is designed for a human being to sit in, and controls to be manipulated by fingers and all that stuff. So now when you have, let's say, this general purpose Anthony Daniels bot, and then all it needs to do, you could plug it into any of those antiquated aircraft and suddenly make them significant for something.
I don't know if you would do that. I mean, because the challenge is those systems were built for human reaction speeds and times. And by the time you get to a robot that can actually do that, you know, you're better off.
Yes, Andrew, there is a better example I could have come up with. I apologize. but I guess that was the first thing that popped to mind, but I'm certain that there are a lot of other human-based systems.
Yeah.
I
hear what you're saying. I think like Palmer's talk about, like, if you want to put like an advanced, you know, let's say satellite, you know, listening station, you know, somewhere, or you have a, you know, a maintenance bay or something like that. But I get what you just, you know, again, I'm not saying that's gonna happen. I'm giving away that.
I think his point was anything that would require an able-bodied man in his 20s or 30s will probably take a little bit longer, and that we might never we might never replace like the Marine that's in the peak of his physical condition and is probably augmented with, you know, other stuff, that like, that's going to be something that will take a very, very long time, and we'll probably have a harder time replacing them, considering we'll have augmented them with AI and, you know, like things that will make them more lethal. But, you know, right now it's like, if it can be done slowly, but surely, like, these robots are here now. I think that before we were like, it could be doing so much more. It's like, that's a huge milestone.
What I say, like, the Neo.
All right, guys, I gotta drop off. I will see you later.
All right,
Brian.
So long.
What? I'm on the 1x.tech website, which I think you were there. What do you think of the aesthetic of the weird bodysuit on it?
Hold on. This is, let me see if I can get that open. Was that the video that I was playing, or?
There's the 1x.tech website.
I'll tell you what, if you have is there an easy URL? I'm working across the room, unfortunately.
Yeah, I thought I sent it. Let me check again.
I had the tweet.
Yeah, 1x. I sent you, I emailed it to you 5 minutes ago. Okay. The 1x, it's 1x.tech.
Oh, is that just the URL? I could do that.
Yeah.
1x.tech. And it's loading up now. Let me see if I could switch us over to it. This one?
Yeah. So they have...
I mean, to be honest, it looks an awful lot like the I'm going to use air quotes, robots from the Nostromo on the Disney original Black Hole. Spoiler alert, it was the dead zombified crew of the Nostromo.
I was going to go for Woody Allen and Sleeper, but yeah.
Or no, Nostromo was Alien. Oh, doggone it. I forgot the name of the ship from the Black Hole. But anyway.
Oh, yeah. Probably something from The Tempest because that's what they based it on. But yeah
it was definitely The Tempest. It really does uncannily look like a human,
a Black Mirror episode.
It's the fabric on the outside that really short circuits my mind. I'm like, it's wearing clothes, and for some reason, I don't want to say it's, you know, deeply upsetting, but it's you notice, you know.
Can we talk about this antimatter key ray?
I was just thinking that. I was like, that's a choice for a looped GIF.
So the audio listeners, which is everybody, they have a video showing the robot dropping keys onto like a coin tray, and it's a looped video, and they fade it out, so it just keeps dropping the keys. The keys just fade away, vanish.
But it ends up looking as though, because the key holder is a prominent display, it ends up looking like, if you didn't know better, you would think that it's not the robot's hand that's the feature. It's this amazing key melting tray.
Yeah, I'm not a big fan of the fabric.
Yeah, I think that the mere fact that we are talking about it means it was a clever design choice. Whether or not long term it's we like it or not, it tickles the uncanny valley even more. Like,
yeah, I've seen other companies do this too, and I get that I kind of like, yeah, like I call me old fashioned. I want my robots to look like robots.
Well, think about this. I mean, I'd hate to, this is going to get dark here real quick. We were talking about military applications of stuff. Here's a thing that a 70-year-old man could do: dress him up, put a hood on him, have him shuffle down the street, maybe carrying a bomb into a crowd. Like that's some scary stuff that only a bipedal, slowly shuffling Anthony Daniels bot could do.
Okay. Devil's advocate. Why wouldn't you just put, you know, your PET explosive on a drone and fly it in there really fast?
Oh, I don't know. Let's say because it's a dramatic third act reveal at the end of my movie. That's why.
Right. I think it gets to be we'll see all kinds of uses for these, good uses, bad uses, stuff like that. But I'd be like, the you know, watching what's been going on in the Ukraine and whatnot with drone stuff. Like, I got a channel that just shows me, here's the latest way they figured out how to arm a drone and blow up some, you know, Russian piece of military equipment. And, you know, and then, yeah. So like, yeah, I think that it's going to be, you know, I would say that often the actors that do that sort of stuff, it's often cheaper to just recruit somebody to do it, weirdly enough. But
if we're playing with future house money, unfortunately, and I think you're tickling at the same spot that I'm realizing now, by the time these resources are this ubiquitous, the very idea of using them this way will be antiquated.
No, but maybe not. I mean, I don't, again, I'm terrible predicting these things. I'm very terrible. The things like, you know, I've said that like, oh, we would never do that. I'm like, no, we did it. I'm like, oh, okay. So,
you know, what's wild is I have 100% rate of getting my predictions right, but a 0% rate of remembering. That was just a joke. Set up and then the why. Anyway, I got a pick for you, Andrew.
Go for it.
Have you read the first 15 lives of Harry August?
Why is that familiar?
It came out in 2014. by somebody, Claire, someone. Hold on, I can find this. This was a suggestion that came to us from our friend Andrew Heaton, and he brought it up, and I threw it in my queue, and I totally forgot. Claire North, the first 15 lives of Harry August. I put it in my queue and forgot why I put it in there, and I just started reading it, and then I had to do the weird thing of like recommending it to a bunch of my friends, and it was Heaton that said, "Yeah, dummy, I'm the one that recommended it to you," and I'm like, "Yay, mystery solved!" It's great. Basically, a dude is born in the 20s, lives a life, dies, and then he's 4 years old in the 1920s again, except he remembers everything. And then goes a little bit batty, ends up in an insane asylum, jumps out a window, wakes up, and it's in the 20s, and he's 4 years old and remembers everything. And so goes on a Groundhog Day-like journey, and then things get really interesting when he discovers he's not the only one. And after that, I'll hold back for spoiler's sake, but the opening scene, like literally the opening scene, is him dying again and then a 6 year old girl walks into the room and they're like, Hey, she's like, "Look, I need a favor. I need you to pass a message along." He's like, "Okay." And, so you and I often engage in the game of, if this is true, then what else is true? Right. So if there's more than one person who can live a life and, you know, loop it again and again and again, what else would be true? Well, they would probably find each other, and they would find each other by their behaviors, like, oh, I don't know, avoiding downtown on September 11th, 2001, et cetera. Mm-hmm. And there are some linears, as they're called, who have pieced together that, well, something's happening. There was a club in Vesuvius, just at the foot of Vesuvius, that packed up and left about a month before the volcano blew. And outside of those artifacts, there's scant details, but it's really interesting. It gave me a new brain play space. It felt like a bigger, more expansive, if you enjoy the fantasy of everything from, you know, Primer to Groundhog Day to Edge of Tomorrow to Russian Doll, right alongside those, I would say this
is... Or if you like Ken Grimwood's book, Replay, which is exact premise.
Oh, is it? I haven't read this one. Great. Sign me up for more.
And again, it's a wonderful premise to explore. So that's about a guy that dies and wakes up, relives his life, finds out that he can make changes in it, finds a woman, somebody else who's going through the same thing. He finds her because he knows how life plays out, figures out how to game it, and then he sees the 1974, this movie called Starseed comes out, directed by Steven Spielberg with VFX by George Lucas. He's like, "Wait a second," and he finds the producer of this person, like, "You knew," and he like finds out that she's also reliving lives. And so
there's a brief hint of it. It doesn't belabor it. It only gives you fleeting moments that are a lot of fun, but like out in one of his lives, you know, he's deciding, "Screw it, I'm going to take some time off," and he's out in like the Himalayan mountains or whatever, encounters somebody else, and something about the way the guy is talking is kind of curious, and he kind of pauses, and the guy walks off, and then he just blurts out, he goes, "Tiananmen Square," and the guy kind of freezes, and he turns and goes, "Huh, good day to you too," and he's like, and he goes, "Chernobyl, Building 7. and then the guy turns around and he goes, "Well, Michael effing Jackson to you too." it's fun. I really enjoy it. And it does a good job of playing within the waters. And it's respectful of the many worlds theory and the every single decision makes branches stuff. I liked it a lot. The first 15 lives of Harry August.
Cool. Y'all check that out. Yeah. And also like Replay by Ken Grimwood. Another one is like, that was, I was recommending when I was working, doing magic on the cruise ships. And a guy said, "You should check this book out." And that really profoundly changed me and made me think about the idea of hypothesizing, what am I going to know at the end of my life that I should know now?
And then and that's one of the things I actually, this is maybe more of an after thing subject, but we, you know, when you live multiple lifetimes, the fact that your body happens to be that of a second grader doesn't impact your wisdom or your intelligence or any of that stuff. So, you know, this kid is just like, yeah, I already know the answer. I'm going to cut to the good part. And then you realize that there's an applicable lesson to the way we live our lives. It's like, there's no reason you can't just speak with authority and you know, get this person or that person on the line for things. Like, there's no physical barrier. There's just whether or not you present congruently as somebody who is deserving of that attention.
The takeaway that I had, and I thought about this too when I watch or listen to or read like vampire stuff, was because my takeaway was like, oh, one would be, how do I achieve financial security? And I'd be like, well, you would invest in, you'd know, like, I'm going to invest in Apple, this, and this. And I remember that conflated with a quote by Warren Buffett, where Warren Buffett talked about how when he would decided to invest in Coca-Cola, you know, the story about why he decided to invest in Coca-Cola is he said that, you know, because Warren Buffett likes to invest in value brands that have persistent value that transcend beyond just the, because he thinks these things are going to be around forever, are going to have good returns continuously.
Whereas Coca-Cola is like the quintessential example of it's fizzy sugar water. Its value is entirely in the brand, essentially.
Yeah. And he said that, you know, he was researching, because he thought about it like, well, should I and whatnot? And he was researching it. And then he found where somebody else had come to the same conclusion and said, you know, every now and then an investor looks around at Coca-Cola and thinking that, you know, maybe I should look at it, but realizes that its best days are probably behind it. And it was written in 1934. Huh. And he goes, buying. And he says, yeah, if somebody came to that conclusion, then they're wildly off. And that was the thought. I said, okay, so what do I, that was my thinking was, I remember, you know, because you'd be like, oh, if I could go back in time to tell myself, because if I read this in, say, 2010, if I go back in time, what would I tell myself? Oh, buy Google, buy Apple. Well, guess what? Yeah, I couldn't go back in time from 2010 to 2000 to buy those companies, but I could have bought them in 2010.
Yeah.
And had I bought them in 2010, it would feel a lot like, you know, as in many ways, as if I bought them even 10 years earlier from a practical point of view. My takeaway from this was, if I lived this long life, I would probably go back and tell myself what to invest in. And then I'd have to think about, like, well, what do I really feel solid about this now? Like, oh, well, those are the companies I'd invest in now.
Well, and that is a really useful thought exercise, is like, okay, imagine you really did just time travel from the future and you only held on to the fact that you were supposed to tell yourself to invest in something, but you forgot along the trip. Try to remember what you in the future told yourself to invest in. And, you know, whether it's, and that goes for everything beyond money, like, you know, not just speculating on stocks or investing in real estate, but it's also investing in, you know, your intelligence, in your body, in your network of friends and acquaintances and so on.
Yeah, 100%. So yeah, I think that you could run the simulation, figure out the advice, and then you just go apply it now.
Yeah.
All right. My pick. I decided to take my wife to Disneyland. We had not been there in 6 years. And part of the reason for not wanting to go was, one, Galaxy's Edge, the Star Wars land, just looked very disappointing, you know, when it looked like, you know, Mozambique junkyard, you know, and I actually use that phrase and I looked that up. I did a Google search Mozambique junkyard and look at Galaxy's Edge, and it is very similar.
Wow.
So I was hesitant to go there because everything about that wasn't really exciting and whatever, but my wife had never been to Disneyland. I said, well, let's go to Disneyland. And they'd opened up, remember when they opened up that Galaxy's Edge, they only had the Smuggler's Run, which is at the Millennium Falcon simulator ride, which mm-hmm. Simulator rides don't move me. Then they opened up the Rise of the Resistance and everybody raved about it. So we went there and we spent 3 days there. We went 2 days there, 1 day at California Adventure, and we had an amazing time. We had a wonderful time. I would say, yes, Galaxy's Edge is a huge disappointment. It is not a magical experience like Harry Potter. Rise of Resistance, though, fantastic ride. I don't know what you know about it, but you know.
Oh yeah, no. Not only did I get to go, but I got to go not knowing anything about it, and I got to go early enough that everybody who was working that ride was clearly pumped, and so yeah. And that's you can't really put a finger on any one thing, but it's like all of the Imperials were just hamming it up, digging the fact that somehow they worked at Disney and yet they were getting paid to be a mean space Nazi and shout at people to get in lines and put them in prison cells. And then the Rebels, boy, were they giddy. They weren't thinking about the fact that they were doing a safety briefing. They were too busy play acting, saying, we gotta go. And man, it was maybe the single best theme park experience of my entire life.
So we won't spoil anything, but it is multi-stages. That's what I loved. It wasn't you just get on a ride and you go through it. There's like three kind of events that take place. And I loved it. It uses the ride tech of, which I could talk about in a second. I thoroughly enjoyed it. We did it once. Lines are crazy. It is worth paying the extra $30 to go on it. Although you might part of it goes, why am I paying? It's like, imagine you were going to pay somebody to wait in line for you. Mm-hmm. Look at it that way. It's a 2-hour wait, or pay somebody $30 to wait in line for you and go do something else, then come back. Did you do Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway?
I did not. I don't know anything about that one.
You missed out. I pity you.
Now keep in mind, I went in Florida.
Yeah, they have it there too.
Okay.
So it used to be the great, that's it. There in Florida, it's at the Hollywood Studios. So it's basically used to be the great movie ride there. And I was like, oh, it's a great movie ride. So the same tech. So Rise Resistance, at one stage, they use these things, these self-moving vehicles, these robots that can control themselves and move around the floor. In Mickey and Minnie's Railway, it starts off with, I'm going to spoil this a little bit because by the time you get there, you'll forget it. You go to a movie theater where they're going to show you a Mickey Mouse cartoon, and they use the new Mickey Mouse cartoons, which are actually really good, really, really good. It's a different style, whatever. You go into a movie theater to go watch the cartoon, and in the cartoon, Goofy's, you know, Minnie and Mickey are going to go on a picnic, and Goofy's driving the train, and then a pie gets loose and gets stuck in the steam stack of the train. The train blows up. And now the movie stopped because there's a hole in the movie screen.
Oh, that's great.
You walk through the goes, oh, folks, well, why don't you come into the cartoon? And so you walk into the movie screen and you get on Goofy's train, and then Goofy's train starts to go along and calamity's happening. You're in your individual train car, which is like the same thing, like a Rise Resistance thing. And it starts spinning out of control, and you go on your own path through all these huge showrooms where they do video projection on the walls. They do these 3D ways of representing Minnie and Mickey with like spherical balls, but animated. Delightful. Absolutely delightful. It was one of the last rides we went on when we were there. I had a grin from ear to ear. I love Rise Resistance technical thing. It's a great experience. But Mickey and Minnie's, oh my God, was such a fun experience. It was just delightful. It was just, you're in a Mickey Mouse cartoon. The first ride based on Mickey Mouse. And it was just a delight. So next time you go.
Yeah. Yeah. No, I'll definitely try that out.
Yeah. So that was my pick. Disneyland was really fun. Really enjoyed going again. It's expensive. It's a lot, you know, but plan for it. Get the multi-pass. Do it. There was a lot to do at doing that. And Mickey and Minnie's Runaway Railway was just, it was just fun. Just fun. It was just a delight.
Right on.
It's been weird.